The views and opinions expressed on the Timeless Voyager series podcast are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Timeless Voyager series podcast or the host, Bruce Stephen Holmes.
With us today, Zachariah Sitchin. He is an author, biblical scholar, linguist, and one of perhaps 200 people who can read the Sumerian tablets. The reason that I have Zachariah Sitchin on the show today is because he has written some incredible books. There are four books called The Earth Chronicles, The Twelfth Planet, The Stairway to Heaven, The Wars of Gods and Men, and The Lost Realms, and most recently, Genesis Revisited. Welcome to the show, Zachariah Sitchin.
Hello, Bruce. Very pleased to be on your show.
All right. You have, I guess in your first book, suggested that according to the Sumerian tablets, which you read, there is a 12th planet.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that, specifically how that occurred and the creation of the solar system according to the Sumerian records?
Yes. Before that, maybe it would be in order to tell the listeners, some or many of whom may not know it, who the Sumerians were. As far as has been now established, the very first advanced civilization, we are talking about a civilization that had cities and kings and priests and temples and writing and the wheel and industry and laws and schools and teachers and taxation. The very first civilization were not the Greek ones and not the Egyptian ones, but were a people called Sumerians in a land that in the Bible is called Shinar, which up to about 150 years ago was totally unknown except for its mention in the Bible in the story of the Tower of Babel. And it is now known that this civilization blossomed out suddenly, scholars use the words unexpectedly out of nowhere, in what is today the southern part of Iraq, near the Gulf of Persia, the Persian Gulf. And one of the incredible contributions of that civilization to us to this very day are not just the first in science, in arts, in literature, and so on, but a series of thousands, literally thousands, of clay tablets with the writing that scholars call cuneiform, in which the history of mankind and the events that preceded the appearance of men on earth are recorded in a most scientific way. Among those tablets and the texts, there are some, especially a series on seven tablets called the tablets, the Epic of Creation, which describes in a manner that has withstood scientific scrutiny, describes how the solar system as we know it has come into being. And according to those tablets, a brief summary or condensation of which represents the first chapter of Genesis in the Bible, according to that, the solar system at the beginning was made up of the sun and the planet we call Mercury. The other planets we know of, except Earth, and instead there was a large planet in the space that is between Mars and Jupiter. And sometime at the very early stage of our solar system, an invader, another planet that was thrust out of its own solar system and was cruising aimlessly perhaps in space, was drawn by gravitational pull into the center of our solar system, collided with that other ancient planet called in the Sumerian text Tiamat, broke that planet into two parts. One part was smashed into bits and pieces and became the asteroid belt that is between Mars and Jupiter. And the other part was thrust into a new orbit to become the planet on which we live, the planet Earth. And according to the Sumerian text, that invader itself was caught into permanent orbit around our sun, an orbit that lasts 3,600 years of our years, Earth years, and every 3,600 years it appears or reappears in that place of the collision. The text calls it the place of the celestial battle between Mars and Jupiter.
Now, you actually claim that this planet, and of course I understand that many astrophysicists now refer to this as Planet X. Is that correct?
Well, the evidence based on perturbations in the orbits of Uranus and Neptune and other evidence suggests to many astronomers that there must be some other large or relatively large celestial body, in other words, a planet, beyond Pluto, which is the farthest planet out still known to us. And whether they refer to the same planet described by the Sumerians or not is yet to be determined. The point is that the Sumerians said that the solar system has 12 members, and thus Bruce, the title of the first book, the 12th planet, and that is the sun, the moon, and 10 planets, the 12th member being the additional one, the invader that got caught into orbit, that the Sumerians called Nibiru, and the Babylonians later called Marduk. So the Sumerians said, and knew of, and even depicted pictorially, and I give the pictures in my books from their ancient tablets, that there's the sun, moon, and all the planets we know of, plus one more. Now, whether the astronomers who say, yes, there ought to be one more planet beyond Pluto, mean the very same planet or another planet, I'll be surprised if there are two more planets out there. So I believe that the planet that they call Planet X, and that they're actively looking for it, I believe that that is the one that the Sumerians called Nibiru. But I don't know if the astronomers buy the Sumerian evidence.
Now, you have actually shown in your book, Genesis Revisited, you've mentioned that the Earth's crust is such that this also gives a lot of strange anomalistic information, doesn't it?
Yes, the fact is that according to the Sumerian epic of creation, Earth, when it was created, was really half a planet, half of Tiamat. And we still see two major phenomena, without going into too many technical details or scientific details. One is that we know that Earth began with all the continents, all that unwounded part of the crust of the Earth on one side, and the continents then began to break up and to move about, and that's called the plate tectonics theory. And on the other side, we still have that a vast cavity, vast wound, that is the Pacific Ocean. So though when you look at the Earth from space, it appears as a globe, if you were to siphon off the water of the oceans, you would see that it's really only half a planet, which is what the Sumerians have said to begin with.
Now, the planet was called Tiamat, is that correct?
The one that was destroyed, yes.
Was the moon of Tiamat Kingu?
Right.
That became our moon, is that correct?
Right.
Now, it's unbelievable that the Sumerians would know this much about the astronomy. Where did they get their information?
The Sumerian knowledge that was amazing in many respects, and especially so in astronomy, is not limited, by the way, Bruce, to the few aspects that we have described. Our moon, which, as you said correctly, was a moon or a satellite of Tiamat, was only the largest one of 11 moons, 11 satellites of Tiamat. And this is what the Sumerians described. They said, for example, that the invader, Nibiru or Marduk in its Babylonian name, had 7 satellites. Now, we are now talking about texts that were written down about 6,000 years ago. Now, who could conceive 6,000 years ago not only this cosmogony, all this tale, but who could conceive even that one person would know that our moon is what one would call it today, a satellite, that a planet could have more than one if all we see is one. Now, astronomers in recent times and over the past one or two centuries have discovered that other planets like Jupiter and Saturn have many satellites. So now we accept that Sumerian tale, Tiamat had, according to them, 11 satellites, fine. But who could conceive of such a thing, that a planet could have more than one satellite? So this is one other example of the amazing knowledge of the Sumerians. And you're quite right in asking, how could they have known all that without the modern equipment that we have, even without telescopes? And they provided the answer to this and to many other puzzles of their amazing knowledge. They said, all that we know, we were taught by the Anunnaki. And the term Anunnaki literally meant those who from heaven to earth came.
All right, now the Anunnaki came from this planet, Nibiru, is that right?
Right.
The Anunnaki. Let's talk about the Anunnaki then.
Okay. What do you want to know about them?
All right, who are the Anunnaki? Because we tend to think of all of this stuff when we first hear it as tales of mythology, and yet you're telling us this is not what it is it?
Well, actually, I'm glad you brought up this point, and that is this. In my books, I quote Sumerian and biblical and other ancient texts from the ancient Near East and from Egypt. I show in hundreds of illustrations, if I add up all the illustrations in the 5 books to date, there are close to 600 of them, which except for some of, sketches and drawings that I prepared to illustrate the orbits and so on, are all from ancient artifacts discovered by archaeologists. So all this information is not information, is not data, are not tablets that I have discovered. These are discoveries made by archaeologists over the past 150 years. There are many who have toiled, who have devoted lifetimes to studying them and deciphering them and publishing those texts. And they're all available. And the question is, why am I the first one who says, hey, do you know what they're telling us? They're telling us that there's another planet in our own solar system, that people with an advanced technology came from there to Earth about 500,000 years ago, that they came for their own reasons in need of gold with which to protect their own dwindling atmosphere. They had tremendous ecological problems on their planet. And in the course of needing working power, working men, to do the mining for them, they jumped the gun on evolution and created the Adam, which is you and me. So I'm asked, well, how come nobody else says that? I said, well, this is not exactly so, because first of all, the Bible says that. And secondly, the difference between me and others is that when they find and read and publish and teach those texts, they call them mythology. There is, for example, a text that describes the first landing, the first splashdown by the group of 50, let's call them astronauts, from Nibiru on Earth, splashing down in the Persian Gulf. Their leader was called Enki, and the text describes the splashdown and how they waded ashore and so on. Now, this text is called The Myth of Enki and the Earth. And I said, what if it, this is not a myth, what if it really happened? And this is where I part company from all the other scholars whose work I have not only used, but whom I admire greatly. I say, what if it is not a myth? What if it really happened?
All right, so this is what separates you, and of course it makes your books very interesting. Now let me just rehash this for a moment. Let's talk for a moment about this planet. The planet is called Nibiru, and my understanding is that it has a 3,600-year cycle. Is that correct? And an elliptical orbit that takes it millions of miles outside of our solar system.
Billions.
Billions with a B, is that right? That's pretty far away. No wonder we don't know it's there. And that it is, I guess, approaching again, is that right?
Pardon?
That this planet Nibiru is approaching us again.
It is on its way back, right?
So, let's talk then for a moment about the people that came from that planet. They are called the Nephilim. Is that correct?
The Bible calls them Nephilim, which literally means the same thing as the Sumerian name means Nephilim, those who fell down, who splashed down from the heavens to earth.
All right. So in Genesis, and I would like you to just talk about this for a minute, we always come across the term Nephilim, but it's very, very short. Why don't you tell us what is missing then from Genesis?
Well, if I may tell you and your listeners a personal story, this is how really this word in the Bible, Nephilim, how I got involved in the whole subject that has come to dominate my life. I was studying the Bible in its original Hebrew language as a schoolboy, and we reached chapter 6 of Genesis, which is the one in which the story of Noah and the Ark and the Great Flood is told. And that story is preceded by several very enigmatic verses, which are obviously the remainder, the balance of some longer text. And they begin to describe the time before the deluge. And it says that those were the days when there were giants upon the earth, and they married the daughters of men and had children by them and so on. And I raised my hand and said, but excuse me, teacher, why do you say giants when the word Nephilim means those who have come down to earth from the heavens? And he reprimanded me. He said, Sitchin, sit down. You don't question the Bible. But I did not question the Bible. I tried to uphold the true meaning of a biblical term. So this reference in the Bible to beings that are also described as the sons, plural, of the gods, plural, who married the daughters of men, specifically the females of some other race, that triggered the whole thing. And as I started to research it, I found out that these biblical texts in the beginning of the book of Genesis are really abbreviated versions of the same Sumerian text, which in time I learned to read and understand.
So our understanding of Genesis is basically we leave out the Nephilim, don't we?
Well, in recent times, I can't claim that it is entirely due to my writings, but the fact is that the most recent translations of the Bible in English, at least I don't know about, I didn't check the other languages, and when they come to this verse in chapter 6 of Genesis, they no longer say giants, but they leave the Hebrew term Nephilim in italics.
So they don't even want to translate it now?
Well, they sort of say, you go and find out for yourself what it means.
I guess my question then is that we're told that God made man in his image. Are we to understand that the Nephilim made man in their image?
Yes, and let me point this out to anyone who thinks that there's conflict between Bible and evolution. There's absolutely no such conflict. If people who believe in the evolution theories would read carefully the Bible, and I'm helping them do that, especially with my latest book, Genesis Revisited. And if fundamentalists would read the Bible, if they could, in its original Hebrew language, and understand exactly what the Bible says. That particular verse, which you just mentioned, Bruce, does not say that God created man. It says that the Elohim, which is a plural term, which means literally from the Akkadian, the lofty ones, said to one another, let us, in the plural, create the Adam after in our image and after our likeness. And this is a plural terms of those who are consulting or speaking to each other about a decision to create a being called the Adam, which literally means the earthling. And in the Sumerian texts, of which many have been found, not just a single one, which enlarge on that subject, it is told and explained in great detail that needing manpower, needing workers for the mines, for the gold mines, a decision was made to take a being which, according to the Sumerian text, clearly states it already exists, meaning, let's call it in simple terms, ape man, ape woman, and implant on it the image, the genes of the Anunnaki, and thus jump the gun on evolution and create in a manner that is exactly the way we now use to create test tube babies, to create what they call the Adam, or sometimes also called the primitive worker. So what the Anunnaki did, consulting among themselves, exactly as the biblical verse states, let us create the Adam in our image and after our likeness, just simply jumped the gun on evolution and through genetic engineering mixed their genes with the dose or with the egg of a female ape woman, let's call her, to create Homo sapiens. So, you know, this whole talk, there's been a search for years for the so-called missing link between early hominids and Homo sapiens, modern men. And the truth is there's absolutely no missing link, because somebody came here and, engaging in genetic engineering, skipped the link and just brought us about.
What exactly is the image then of the Nephilim? Do we look like them or do they look like us?
I like the way you put it, because most people ask me, do they look like us or did they look like us? And I say, no, we look like them. And you asking one question, both possibilities. They made us. They made us, as the Bible says, and as the Sumerian text say in much greater detail. They made us in their image, which means physically looking like them, and after their likeness, which means emotionally and spiritually like them. So we are like them. They are not like us. We are like them. And there are many Sumerian and other Near Eastern depictions they showed them. Many of them were much taller than the average human being. But basically, they looked like us.
The Anunnaki are Nephilim that came to Earth. Is that correct?
Right.
All right, because we've got these terms, I don't want to get too confusing. The Nephilim came from the planet Nibiru.
Right.
All right, so now they came down here over 500,000 years ago. I mean, that is our first contact with them, and they are the ones who genetically engineered the human as it is now.
About 300,000 years ago, not right away.
Oh, so they lived on this planet for about 200,000 years.
Before they jumped the gun on evolution to create Homo sapiens.
Now, you say in your book, and of course, this was the thing that really made me feel rather disappointed, the only reason they made mankind in the first place was they needed someone to mine gold.
Well, this has disappointed many who thought that there must be some more noble reason for man's or Homo sapiens appearance. However, I don't think that such people should be disappointed at all, because though the Anunnaki or Nephilim, as the Bible calls them, came here, and maybe they themselves thought that they are jumping the gun on evolution to bring us about just for their own selfish reasons, I really believe, Bruce, that there is some grand universal purpose to the whole thing. I think that within, in universal terms, there is some grand design and a destiny. And I really believe that no matter how our advanced type of hominid came about, that we are too destined to go into space. Whether Congress allows or budgets more money or less, or there is a space station or not, or whether the Soviets raced the United States for Mars or not, I think that there's a grand design, there's a destiny, and that one day we will go out into space and on some distant planet will do exactly what was done to us. So the fact that the Anunnaki Nephilim thought or actually did do what they did for specific selfish reasons should not detract from the belief which I have that there is some grand design and there's a destiny in the universe and for mankind.
Can we assume that the Nephilim were genetically engineered by someone else?
Please.
I was saying, can we just assume then that the Nephilim themselves were actually engineered by some other culture that predated them?
Well, according to the Sumerian text, the seed of life was brought into the solar system, our solar system, and imparted to Earth during that collision, which we've discussed at the beginning of the program. Now, how did the seed of life develop, or how was it implanted on Nibiru? Just by itself, or as you suggest or ask, was it also brought over from somewhere else? There is no answer to that in the Sumerian texts, which are the foundation of my writings. But I wouldn't be surprised at all if this is part of that eternal process in the universe, that one solar system is created and a star dies or explodes and its planets are thrust out and whatever is on them, life, seed of life, genetic material is transported to another part of the universe, and that this goes on and on. That is, that's not out of my feelings and my beliefs.
We look like the Nephilim, but you say that they are a little taller. How tall are they?
Well, there were quite a number of them, so I don't know if they were all made from a single mold, but they do appear in the depictions taller than the people who approach them, either as priests or kings. So, I don't know, 8 feet, 9 feet.
Well, that's pretty big. I mean, was Goliath, and David and Goliath, was Goliath a Nephilim?
Goliath was a descendant. You see, they had many human descendants as a result of the intermarriage, which is described in chapter 6 of Genesis. And in the Sumerian text, there are even names named of descendants of the offspring of between a male Anunnaki and a human female, or vice versa. And for example, the famous King Gilgamesh, whose city Erech is mentioned in the Bible, he was the son of a goddess, or so-called goddess, one of the female Anunnaki, by the high priest of the city, of the temple. So, according to the Bible, Goliath was a descendant of such an offspring.
Okay, now, of course, just because, was he really a bad guy, or is that just part of the story?
Well, I don't know. The Israelites considered him a bad guy. The Philistines considered him a hero. So it depends on which side you are.
All right, I don't want to stay on this too long because there are so many other things to talk about. But I think the thing that I was very shocked about was you've mentioned even something about the grays that we hear about in the UFO community.
Yes, according to the Sumerian text, and I enlarge more on that subject in the latest book, Genesis Revisited. Before the Anunnaki landed here, they sent, and after they had landed, and during that long stay of theirs and comings and goings, they sent ahead of them, and they utilized as emissaries those little gray people, barring a better way to call them or to describe them, which people who say that they saw them when there were UFO sightings, or who describe abductions as people with the smooth skin, they appear to be asexual. When they ask for the male, female, most or all answer, we don't know, that we didn't see any sexual difference. That had in most descriptions, a pear-shaped head and big eyes relative to the size of the head, and such emissaries of the Anunnaki or biblical Nephilim are described, and even pictorially, in the Sumerian tablets, and according to the same sources that I've been quoting from ancient times, on the way to Earth, the Anunnaki had a way station on Mars. And events that happened on Mars, both discoveries of very enigmatic and apparently artificial or man-made features on Mars, and 2-3 years ago, the incident of the loss of a Soviet spacecraft at Mars, suggested to me that that space base has been reactivated, and it is quite feasible that the various UFO sightings with such beings, such emissaries, which are robots, androids, they are not the Anunnaki themselves, that they are coming from that reactivated space on Mars, and I deal with that extensively in Genesis Revisited.
All right, now we just opened up a whole new area here. I wanted to ask you, and I don't mean to jump around, but I think this is interesting. You basically have said that there's a very interesting similarity between Halley's Comet and the orbit of the planet Nibiru. Could you expound on that?
Well, Halley Comet has, a mini orbit like that of Nibiru. It is only about 75 or 76 years compared to the 3,600 of Nibiru. But it has the same inclination. It passes, it cuts through the what is called the ecliptic, the plane at which all the other planets orbit, in the same manner that Nibiru does. And if you describe the orbit of Halley's Comet and increase it so many fold from 75 to 3,600, you actually have the orbit of Nibiru in front of you.
All right, so that is kind of a little bit of maybe not proof, but certainly a good example of the fact that we can have something that comes through our solar system from a very far away place. Do the Nephilim use the circular pattern around the sun as a determination for a year? In other words, do they grow slower than us?
Oh, that I'm glad you bring it up, because the whole notion from ancient times of the immortality of the gods, you know, in which the Greeks had the many tales, also called myths, that the gods were immortal, is only an illusion due to this difference. Because when we say that someone has lived among us, 80 years, we really are saying that he lived long enough to orbit the sun 80 times, because that's the definition of a year, one orbit around the sun. Now, for somebody who lives on Nibiru, what we call 3,600 years is really just 1 year, one orbit around the sun. So it's exactly as if flies, if they could talk, would talk in my home about me. And Papa Fly would tell his son, you know, this man, they call him Sitchin, he is immortal, because my father told me that his father told me that as far as we generations of flies can remember, he was always there, and he never changes. So this whole notion of immortality of those who came to Earth from Nibiru really has to do, as you pointed out, with this differential in the length of the orbit.
All right, I don't mean to jump around, but I want to come back now to this idea. So what the Nephilim were doing was they came down here to mine gold. My understanding is the Anunnaki, who were supposed to not mine the gold, didn't want to do it. Is that correct?
Well, at the beginning they did, and that's the gap or the time lapse of almost 200,000 years from their initial landing until they engaged in genetic engineering. But at some point, and there were not too many of them, those who were sent to do this hard work, in spite of all the tools they had, said, enough is enough. We are, let's say, to quote them, we are astronauts, and we are not miners, and some other solution is to be found to the problem. And the chief scientist of the Anunnaki said, I have a solution. There is already a being on Earth that can do the job. All we need is to give it some intelligence, to put our imprint on it, and thus was the genetic engineering process.
All right, so what I'm leading to here, though, is the purpose of this creation of mankind, again, as we go through, was to make, or rather to mine gold. But what I want to ask you is, you mentioned that the gold was somehow used or vaporized in their atmosphere to somehow correct a problem they had with their ecology. Is there information on how they actually did this?
Well, no, there's no detailed information on that, because the Sumerian texts deal with what was happening on Earth and not so much with what was happening on Nibiru. But some texts have mentionings of this and that and various facts that indicate the reason for coming here and the problems that they had on their planet. And it is putting all this together, it seems that the problem was that their atmosphere was dwindling. They were losing their atmosphere, and it endangered all life on Nibiru, and that their scientists felt that the only way to save or sustain that atmosphere that still remained was to create a shield of gold particles above the atmosphere, to suspend it above their atmosphere, which would do two things. One is would retain the atmosphere that they had, and second, help create a greenhouse effect and thus add to the warmth of their planet.
All right, now, I need to ask you this. You mentioned the planet Mars. Let's come back and find out here once and for all. You're saying that there's an ancient Mars base that the Nephilim used, and it's being currently used again by the Greys. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is this also on the moon Phobos?
Well, the moon, the Mars has two moons. One is called Phobos, and one is called Deimos. The larger one is called Phobos. And as I'm sure your many listeners know, when the United States sent a spacecraft to Mars, unmanned spacecraft, in the 1970s, and took photographs of the surface of Mars, some of the pictures sent back included some very unusual and puzzling pictures. One of them is a rock that appears to have been carved to look like a human face, and this has been discussed and shown in magazines and on television, the face of Mars. But there are much more compelling or convincing features that look like the remains of structures, of buildings, and even of a spaceport, and that's how the situation stood unresolved until there would be an actual landing on Mars to explore those features for almost 20 years. Now, in 1989, the Soviets had a spacecraft called Phobos 2 after the moonlet. There was also a Phobos 1, but it's claimed that it was lost on the way. Phobos 2 reached Mars and started to orbit Mars with great international participation, some other 13 European countries and other countries in the world, including American scientists. And this spacecraft called Phobos 2 also started to send pictures which were not made public at the time. Its mission was to change orbit and fly in tandem with the moonlet Phobos, just 50 feet above it, because there were many enigmas connected with this moon. One of them is various data concerning it that suggest that it could be hollow. Then there are all kinds of tracks upon it, which were also puzzling. The Soviets, one of the missions was to bombard this moonlet Phobos with laser beams and see what happens. And as the time neared to do that, and and the spacecraft started to change orbit to be put into position for that. Some very puzzling shadows. One that looks like the shadow of an elliptical object. Another that looks like something elongated, very elongated, appeared in the photograph sent back by the spacecraft. And just the day before it was supposed to bombard the moonlet with laser beams, something hit the Soviet spacecraft, put it into a spin and put it out of action. And the question is, was it an accident or was it an incident? And as I describe and give some of this information, there'll be much more in a forthcoming TV documentary that has been prepared based on Genesis Revisited. But I give enough information in the book. To me, it all seemed like a repeat of the incident of the Tower of Babel, when mankind was building what we would call today a launch tower, and somebody from up there came down, these are the biblical words, came down to see what men were doing, and said to his colleagues, we cannot let mankind do it, because if we let them do it, nothing would be impossible for mankind. And the tower was destroyed and mankind was dispersed. So to me it sounds like a repeat of that biblical situation.
So without being paranoid, certainly one of the things that the Nephilim did not want, is this what you're saying, is for us to know what they know?
Well, each time they were here, every 3,600 years, they gave us a new dose of knowledge of technology. And maybe they intended to do this next time around. But it appears that from time to time, as the biblical tale of the Tower of Babel tells us, maybe mankind is getting ahead of their of the Anunnaki's timetable or schemes, or we intrude unintentionally, perhaps, on their space base or their space program. And they say, don't do that. So what happened, the knowledge that was obtained from these enigmatic Mars features and especially what happened in 1989, Bruce, in my opinion, can explain many of the changes that have taken place on Earth, the changed relationship between the superpowers and many other things which we don't have the time to go into.
That's right. Unfortunately, we are out of time. And for those of you who have been listening, Zechariah Sitchin is the guest. He is the author of 5 books, 4 books from the Earth Chronicles, The 12th Planet, The Stairway to Heaven, The Wars of Gods and Men, The Lost Realms, and of course, the recent book, Genesis Revisited. He is a biblical scholar and a linguist, as I said before, one of 200 who can actually read the Sumerian tablets, but what separates him from them is that he says this is not mythology. Zechariah Sitchin, is there anything you'd like to say at the end of the show?
Well, I think that we should have another talk some other time in the near future, because we have barely scraped the subject. We have barely touched on all the amazing things that the ancient peoples knew and wrote down for us to also know.
Well, I want to thank you for being on the show today. Thank you so much.
Father, mother, sister, planet. light, warm and tender, so real.